Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Melina, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Workshop, Ovarian Cancer Treatment Options and Current Perspectives. And this is really such an important teleconference that we're doing today, and today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have been able to reach out to so many of you. We have on the call today over 914 participants, and you come from all over the United States. You come from large cities and small cities. You come from suburban areas, as well as rural and frontier communities. We also have international participants from Africa, Australia, Cameroon, Canada, Colombia, India, Italy, Pakistan, Virgin Islands, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world, and it's really a credit to you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that has been prepared by our speakers, and there is information about all of the different collaborating organizations. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you each to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. And when you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs that we should be offering? And so we very much appreciate your feedback so that we can choose topics and programs that are most relevant to meet your needs. Indeed, today's program was one that many of you have requested, and actually you've shown by your participation today that you really want to hear more about this topic. So tell us what you'd like us to do, and we'll try very hard to do it. Today's program was made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. Now, we have just wonderful speakers on the program today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker, Dr. Carolyn Runowitz. Dr. Runowitz is Director, Carol and Ray Nieg Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northeast Utilities Chair in Experimental Oncology. She's Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology, Division of Gynecologic Oncology, the University of Connecticut Health Center. And Dr. Runowitz is going to address an overview of ovarian cancer, staging, current standard of care, and new treatment approaches. It's really my privilege to now turn the program over to Dr. Runowitz.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be here today, and I'm delighted that there is such a large turnout. So hopefully we can provide an overview of ovarian cancer and then tell you some of the new exciting findings at recent conferences and from recent research. So as most of you know, ovarian cancer is a cancer that we think originates in either the fallopian tube or the ovaries. There's been some new research that suggests that there are two types of ovarian cancer. The first type is a grade 1 confined to the ovary, and the second type is possibly a tumor that actually starts in the fallopian tube and then spreads out to the ovary as well as to surrounding structures. And that observation and research explains why we detect most of our cancers with ovarian cancer in late-stage disease. Most women who develop ovarian cancer present with stage 3 or 4 disease. And we used to think that this was really a failure of the medical system to diagnose it early, but we're beginning to think now that this is more the biology of the disease, and we're really going to have to rethink our prevention and early detection strategies. The treatment for ovarian cancer currently is to make the diagnosis usually through surgery and then follow that with chemotherapy. At the time of surgery, the disease is staged, so it's either a stage 1, which is confined to the ovaries, a stage 2, which means it spreads slightly beyond the ovaries and the pelvis, a stage 3, where it has spread throughout what we call the peritoneal cavity. And the peritoneal cavity, if you think of your organ sitting in a big saran wrap bag, That would be the peritoneal cavity. And if you think about something like sand or Rice Krispies or something like that, and it shook throughout the saran wrap bag, that would be kind of how ovarian cancer spreads and what it looks like when it's stage three. And then stage four means that it's either in the liver or in the lungs, or that there's fluid around the lungs that tests positive for cancer cells. And the surgical stage, as I said, is most women are diagnosed with a stage three or even a four, but mostly a stage three disease. So following surgery, most women will require chemotherapy. And I think Dr. Mueller will tell us about the importance of clinical trials at this point for women who are diagnosed with ovarian cancer. Currently, the standard non-protocol, non-clinical trial therapy is a combination of Taxol with carboplatin. If you are in Europe, you might just get the carboplatin rather than the combination. But I think in the rest of the world, and certainly in the United States, we give a combination, and we usually do that for six cycles. The way that we give the Taxol and Carbo can either be a standard 21 to 28-day cycle where your drugs are given every 21 to 28 days depending on how you tolerate it. There's been a new regimen that was described a couple years ago, which is being used in the communities and at academic medical centers, called dose-dense. And dose-dense is a modification of what we've seen in breast cancer, which has impacted survival in a favorable way. Dose-dense for ovarian cancer is giving weekly Taxol, and the carboplatin is given every 21 days. And so it's an intense regimen. It has marked marrow suppression, but the overall progression-free survival and survival are better in the initial reports. And another new therapy following surgery is intraperitoneal chemotherapy. And the data on that is for women who have all of their disease or what we call an optimal, where there's very little disease, less than a centimeter and usually way less than a centimeter disease left in a patient after surgery. Intraperitoneal chemotherapy can be delivered in the peritoneum. And by doing that, it's a very intense therapy. But again, the progression-free survival, the time a woman finishes chemotherapy until she may develop a recurrence, was much improved in the intraperitoneal arm. So those are kind of the first-line therapies. Another standard of care, or becoming more of a standard of care, is in women who either can't undergo surgery or the surgeon feels that the surgery will not be successful in removing the bulk of disease. In those patients, chemotherapy can be given up front, so the Taxol and the carboplatin can be given for 3 to 6 cycles as the initial therapy, and then surgery follows that. So the option will depend on the surgeon and will depend on the volume of disease. I think most people on this call recognize that the importance of surgery is dependent upon the training of the surgeon. Carolyn and myself are trained as gynecologic oncologists, which means that we do additional training to be able to do these radical surgeries and to be able to successfully perform what we call optimal or cytoreduced or optimal debulked surgery. So it's important for patients, I think, at some point, if they haven't already, to see a gynecologic oncologist, either for their initial surgery, ideally, but certainly in the management of any future surgeries, a gynecologic oncologist should be available. One can get a gynecologic oncologist through the Society of Gynecologic Oncologists or the Gynecologic Cancer Foundation. These are two organizations that are available through the web, and you can put in a zip code or a state or a town, and the gynecologic oncologist in your neighborhood will show up on a list, and you can then seek consultation. Newer treatment approaches were described at several meetings this year. The Society of Gynecologic Oncologists has a meeting in March, and most recently, many of you may have heard the media coverage of the American Society of Clinical Oncology, and there were some exciting research findings at that time. The research findings that were recently reported included the use of bevacizumab, which is Avastin, which is an anti-angiogenesis agent, and it was used as what we call consolidation therapy. And consolidation therapy is therapy that's given after the initial six cycles of a Taxol carbo and given for a period of time to reduce the risk of recurrence. And it looks like bevacizumab in that upfront setting, either in combination with the chemotherapy, but certainly following the chemotherapy, will result in an improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival. So that was very exciting. There was also some data on some folate receptor antagonists, either antibodies or conjugated with drugs, that also looked very exciting. So I came away from these meetings very optimistic that we've got some new drugs that are really going to be effective and active in ovarian cancer. There was also a screening trial that was presented by investigators at MD Anderson, and what they showed is very similar to what the United Kingdom study showed, that if you do serial CA125s, and most of you know what CA125 is, it's an antigen with a monoclonal antibody that we use to follow patients with ovarian cancer. In a screening program, serial CA125s were used, placed into a statistical formula in combination with sonography if the CA125 calculation was abnormal. And they reported that they were able to find early cancer, and they reported several grade 3 cancers, which would suggest that they are actually finding what we call real ovarian cancer. The mortality data from that trial and from the United Kingdom trial has not been reported yet. So we hope that we will also show that we can reduce mortality from ovarian cancer by these screening programs. So that was pretty exciting data. The American trial, the PLCO, the Prostate, Lung, Colon, and Ovarian Screening Protocol, was reported by Dr. Partridge at the end of last year. And this was using CA125 or SONO, and not necessarily together. And that trial was disappointing in that they did not find early cancers. So I think we're learning a lot about how ovarian cancer starts. We're getting some mature results from these screening studies. And so with that information, I think we'll be able to develop novel screening and prevention strategies. So I'm very encouraged with the novel therapies, with the information on early detection and prevention. I think I probably should stop at this point and let Dr. Mueller tell us a little bit about the importance of clinical trials and working with the healthcare team.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Ronowitz, for just an excellent, really very informative presentation. And I know there'll be lots of questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you as always. And our next speaker is Dr. Carolyn Mueller. Dr. Mueller is professor, director of GYN Oncology, Department of OBGYN and Cancer Research and Treatment Center, University of New Mexico Health Sciences Center. As you can see, both Dr. Runowitz and Dr. Muller wear many hats. And Dr. Muller is going to address the important role of clinical trials, controlling symptoms and pain, communicating with your healthcare team, and quality of life concerns. Dr. Muller?
Thank you, Carolyn. And once again, I'd like to say it's an absolute pleasure to spend my morning, actually, because it's still morning in New Mexico, with all of you. And before I start, the one thing that I do want to do, since I know this is a worldwide audience and many of you are patients and family members of patients, for all of those who have participated in a clinical trial, please give yourselves a round of applause, because without you we could not make these advances that Dr. Runowitz has talked about and I'm going to talk a little bit more about. And for those of you who are here supporting someone who has been on a clinical trial, give them a big hug, because once again, you guys are the heroes that make this all make all these advances happen and make life better for women with ovarian cancer. And with that said, what I'd like to do then is just talk a little bit about clinical trials and why they're so important and why patients need to consider them, particularly at many different times within their journey for cancer. And if I think back when I was in medical school and I was first falling in love with the field of oncology, it was not uncommon to have women hospitalized for their chemotherapy for quite extensive treatments. At that point in time, we used cisplatin as a drug in a very high dose and another drug called Cytoxan. And although we were able to achieve remissions with that, it was not uncommon to have women have such horrible neuropathy that perhaps the rest of their life was committed to using walkers or wheelchairs because of some of the side effects. We're going to talk a little bit about side effects and quality of life issues also. But it was because of advances in clinical trial, it was because an active molecule was discovered by a scientist that was extracted from the bark of a yew tree, and that's how Taxol was born. And then multiple trials that we now consider carboplatin and Taxol as standard therapy. It's because of clinical trials that we were able to find that carboplatin was as good as cisplatin, and we can make it more convenient and give it to patients as an outpatient. And in fact, the neuropathy issues were much, much less than with cisplatin. And now we have the clinical trials that have shown us that in certain scenarios that women who have a combination of these drugs through an intravenous dosing and an intraperitoneal dosing actually live longer without recurrences. And now, from what Dr. Runowitz had mentioned, we now have new targeted agents coming on board, such as bevacizumab. So we really should take a moment here to think of all the women who have participated in these trials, because these are the women who have made it possible to have these advances. So with that said, now I think everybody on the phone is going to say, hey, let's get on a clinical trial. How do I do that? What is a clinical trial? I always hear about phase 1, 2, and 3, and what does all that mean? So let's talk a little bit about what clinical trials are and why they are available at some times and not available at other times. So you will always hear about phase 1, 2, and 3 trials. And phase 1 trials are very early trials. So they are trials that are looking at how to give either new drugs to people, because certainly there's a lot of mice running around in somebody's labs who are living longer because they received the drugs. But now we have to figure out what the proper dose is in patients and what the side effects will be. So these technically are phase 1 trials, and they can be either a brand new drug just coming out of the laboratory, or it can be a brand new drug in a new disease. So for instance, a new drug may have had a particular particular studies in either breast cancer or colon cancer, but it's going to be given in a little different way for ovarian cancer. So those doses need to be figured out so that we know how to give it from then on. Or sometimes it's combining two drugs that have never been put together. So we need to know what the proper doses are so that we can get a good impact against the cancer and not an impact against the person. So those are very, very important studies, and they tend to be the studies that are available to patients regardless of where you are in your journey. So they tend to be whether somebody's been on and off treatment for 5, 6, 7 years, have had a lot of different regimens. These are the trials that still may be eligible to you. Phase 2 trials are the next step, and the next scientific question with a phase 2 trial is, does it work? How well does it work? And what are the side effects once you now start giving it to more people and perhaps giving it over a longer period of time? And these trials tend to be a little bit more rigorous in how much treatment that you have seen before. So in somebody who may have had about 4 or 5 different regimens, these trials may not be ready or be available because they usually tend to be in patients who have not had so much treatment where perhaps if we use the drug in those patients, we may actually have more toxicity than is real, and you may end up then saying, oh, this drug's too hard, where you could lose the real potency, or you could use the real potential of that drug. And then phase 3 trials are what we call the change in practice trials, and these are the trials that led to us and the NCI declaring intraperitoneal therapy as a new standard of care for certain patients with ovarian cancer. And these trials are where we go head-to-head with a new regimen or a new combination against what standard practice is. And sometimes they involve placebos, and sometimes they don't. And just to allay anybody's fear, anytime a trial has a placebo in it, it is never, ever, ever can be anything less than what the standard of care is. So it's not like you're being withheld something that we know is better. It's actually that you're actually at a standard of care. And we can talk a little bit more in question time if that's a particular question for folks. So again, I would encourage patients to really consider clinical trials, talk to your healthcare team about clinical trials, and there are very good sites that can look for clinical trials. We have a site on the Women's Cancer Network, which is WCN.org, which gives a lot of information about clinical trials and links to other clinical trial sites like the NCI site. And that also highlights our gynecologic oncology group trials, many of which are what we've already discussed, which are the trials that have made such good advances. Now, let's talk about something else that's so important to you all, and that's symptom control and pain management, because clearly we know that cancer itself can cause symptoms, and treatments can cause symptoms. And we have to be very, very careful to recognize how to optimize the quality of life in a cancer, again, in your cancer journey. And sometimes if the outcome is such that we know that if we can get through these treatments, the likelihood of remission is so high that we might, you might be willing to tolerate a lot of stuff to get to that endpoint. But if we get to a point where we know that for those of you living with cancer on and off for years, that the philosophy now is the cancer is like a chronic disease, and you're going to be on and off therapy for a while. So always remember that you don't live to get chemo, but you get chemo to help you live. And you have to keep living, and that means that you have to be very honest with your healthcare team and let them know what the symptoms are, and because there are a lot of agents out there that can help with symptoms. For instance, If I asked all of the 914 people across the world to tell me how many of you have neuropathy, how many of you complain of fatigue, how many of you use the word chemo brain, you know, these tend to be the main issues for symptoms related to predominantly chemotherapy, but they can also be related to the disease. And there's there are lots of different ways to manage these. We certainly have some drugs that can help with neuropathy. We have some natural things that can help, such as B vitamins. I live in New Mexico. I have a lot of my patients who do a lot of meditation. Acupuncture has been very, very helpful for many of my patients. And there's some clear evidence as well that maintaining activity and keeping up your activity during the day, if you had some level of exercise, if you try to maintain that, actually your symptoms will be lesser than if you leave that particular regimen. And a lot of this can also be help having support from other patients, support and support groups such as cancer care, or support from the family. And it is very, very clear that if we can, you know, keep you focused, keep you have a positive goal for every day, and just take steps at a time, that certainly symptom and pain control can be less. And I'm very, very happy to say as well that clinical trials are very much paying attention now to quality of life endpoints. Just about every clinical trial that's out there has some level of quality of life endpoints that that really are validated to be able to help us as clinicians, physicians, and researchers to be able to help understand what quality of life impacts our therapies and our research are doing. And I will also make a point that there are two active gynecologic oncology group trials right now that are specifically looking at symptom control and quality of life issues, and one of them is indeed on quote-unquote chemo brain. So, and these are in women who are about to start treatment with ovarian cancer. So I know many, many of you have quality of life concerns, and again, I suggest that you really do talk with your healthcare team. Now, everybody's healthcare team is very, very different. We're all set up a little bit differently. Some centers will have patient navigators, patient advocates. Many of us have mid-level providers. We have study nurses who usually spend an enormous amount of time with the patients on clinical trials. We have nutritionists. We have physical therapists. We have a lot of ancillary people that can help with maintaining and controlling symptoms. But the truth of the matter is, and what I do find oftentimes, is that patients are very, very reluctant to complain to the doctors about their symptoms, because they just, I don't know, there's just that, there's just that, I don't want to complain, I know they're working hard for me, but unless you all talk about it, we can't, we can't help manage the symptoms. And I often suggest a diary or a calendar to bring into the office visit, so that we can actually look at the good days, the bad days, is there a cyclic component to the symptoms, and again, how we can best manage that. So I think I'm going to stop right there, and we'll be able to answer some questions during the question time.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mullah, for really an excellent presentation and very compassionate, and really a lot of attention to both clinical trials and quality of life issues, so important. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Before we take questions, I'd like to introduce Christy Kaye. She's an oncology social worker for cancer care, and she is the clinical coordinator for our L'Oreal Paris Ovarian Cancer Research Fund Hopeline. And she's going to describe to you some of the services that you can access from cancer care. Christy?
I would like to start by talking about the importance of having support when you're diagnosed with ovarian cancer and how cancer care and our Hope Line can be part of you getting that help. As we've learned from today's workshop, there is a lot of information about ovarian cancer to take in, and sometimes it's difficult to understand what this means for you. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer, how ovarian cancer, affects a woman, her family, partners, and friends. They are also trained to help people with cancer and their families tackle the problems that come along with cancer, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and the emotional impact. Adjusting to and coping with the diagnosis of ovarian cancer is an important part of your journey, and you don't have to face it alone. Cancer care can help in many ways, such as our practical support and financial help. If needed, we can also refer you to other financial resources. Our emotional support services are provided in a variety of settings, such as telephone counseling and telephone and online support groups. We realize that cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by contacting a cancer care social worker for counseling or by joining a support group is a sign of strength. Counseling affords you the time to talk about what your individual needs, concerns, and questions may be. Counseling can help you find the tools you need in order to cope with your diagnosis of ovarian cancer. For many of you, talking to a social worker may relieve you from the stress of holding it all inside and shielding your loved ones from your struggles. Cancer Care offers a wide variety of support groups as well. In addition to offering support groups for people with cancer, we also offer support groups for family members, partners, caregivers, and loved ones. Many people find being in a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. Some of the groups that may be of interest for you are our free telephone and online support groups for women with ovarian cancer. Individual counseling and support groups are a safe place where you can talk about your concerns and your worries. These types of connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Being emotionally supported can help you better deal with your diagnosis of ovarian cancer and the treatment you face. All of our services are provided completely free of charge. We want to spread the word about our free supportive services, so please call our Ovarian Hope Line at 1-877-OV-HOPE-1. Again, that's 1-877-684-6731, or visit our website at cancercare.org for more information. In addition, as you now know, our Connect Education workshops provide both disease-specific information, such as today's workshop, and workshops on coping with the physical and emotional impact of cancer. Our fact sheets and booklets are packed with up-to-date information on treatments and the latest coping strategies to help people diagnosed with cancer and those who care for them. These are two additional tools that can help you during your journey with cancer. Again, all of these materials are available free of charge. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you so much for listening today, and we hope to hear from you.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Christy, for really explaining all the different services that all of our attendees can access from Cancer Care and the Hope Line. Thank you. And now we have time for questions. We have actually lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Melina to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we do not get to your question, please call Cancer Care right after the call at 1-800-813-HOPE. And we will take your questions at that point. So, but we're going to take as many as we can right now. Melina?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Our first question comes from Julie S.
Hi. First of all, thanks for doing this, and I agree, thanks to everybody who's ever done a clinical trial. My question is about preventative surgery for people who have either the BRCA1 or BRCA2 defects. There's a recommendation that they have oophorectomies. How would you recommend, first of all, that a gynecological oncologist perform the prophylactic surgeries as well? And in addition to the ovaries, what else do you recommend taking out? I'm assuming fallopian tubes. Would you recommend a complete hysterectomy?
Okay, well, that's an excellent question, and I'm going to ask both Dr. Ronowitz and Dr. Mala to address your question. Dr. Ronowitz, do you want to go first?
Sure. That was a very good question. I recommend that both tubes and ovaries be taken out. The uterus is a little bit controversial. There have been a couple of reports out of Israel that have shown that in BRCA mutations, which is the mutation that we see with inherited ovary and breast cancer, it accounts probably for up to 5, maybe 10% of breast and ovarian cancers. So it is a significant portion of women. So the laparoscopically, though, a bilateral removal of both ovaries and tubes is easier and less morbid than doing a complete hysterectomy. So I think until we see more data, I just recommend that. And I think that the procedure is pretty straightforward, that a gynecologist could do it. The important thing is to get out the whole ovary and not leave a portion of the ovary behind. And I think most gynecologists are trained and comfortable to do that. When you have the laparoscope in, you can turn it around and take a look at the entire abdomen so that you can look up under the diaphragms, you can see the gutters. And I think it's really important that this be done. As far as doing multiple biopsies of other areas, I don't think the research supports that. And I think right now the standard of care would be to remove just the tubes and ovaries, which, you know, I say just. It's a big operation, and it has consequences of premature menopause, but it also reduces ovarian cancer and breast cancer if done in a premenopausal patient.
Thank you, Dr. Ronowitz. Thank you. And Dr. Mala, did you want to add anything? Or?
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think as in should a gynecologist do this, I think if the gynecologist is very much aware of the issues of risk reduction surgery, particularly in women who have a known BRCA1 or 2 mutation, then I think, you know, that's fine. If the gynecologist is not as up to date, so to speak, or one of the other issues is to make certain that the pathologist is aware of why the ovaries and fallopian tubes are coming out. So there needs to be good communication between the pathologist, particularly in women who have known mutation status, because the ovaries and the fallopian tubes have to be looked at in a little different way and quite carefully. And the only thing that I add from the standard procedure that I do after a full exploration, visual exploration of looking all the way up at the diaphragms and in as many nooks and crannies as we can, is that I add pelvic washings to that. So we get a random sample by just putting in some salt water and having it rush over the organs and then collecting that up to look at any free-floating cells that may look abnormal.
Excellent. And, you know, we often recommend that people also, for additional just materials about this, the National Cancer Institute, and that actually is listed in your materials, 1-800, the number 4-CANCER. And we also, the Gynecologic Cancer Foundation, has a lot of materials as well, so that would be a resource as well, and that's also in all of your materials as well. Excellent question. Thank you. Great answers. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Sue M.
Hi. I'm just wondering if the doctors could comment on the use of supplements during chemotherapy and the trials being done by Dr. Jeannie Driscoll out of the University of Kansas using IV vitamin C treatments on ovarian cancer patients even during their chemotherapy treatments.
Thank you. Thank you for the question. Dr. Ronowitz, could you address that?
Yes. I have a real concern, Sue, about taking supplements while you're getting chemotherapy treatments or cancer therapies. We did actually one of the original studies looking at supplement of beta carotene in patients with cervical dysplasia or intraepithelial neoplasia. We did that the same time that the CARROT trial was running, which was beta carotene in smokers. And what the two studies independently showed was the beta-carotene actually caused harm. In the smokers, it increased the risk of lung cancer, and in our women with cervical dysplasia, pre-cervical cancer, it increased the progression to cervical intraepithelial neoplasia 3, which is a more advanced pre-cancer. So there have now been a number of studies that have actually shown no benefit or have shown harm, as the two examples that I just gave you. So I think that the micronutrient that you get in your food, the beta-carotene that's present in a carrot or the lycopene that's present in a tomato, is different than supplementing the individual micronutrient. And the data has been very disappointing, so I caution my patients not to do supplements. As a cancer survivor and as somebody, I've had, many of you may know this because I've been pretty public about it, I've had breast cancer, and I initially was taking a multivitamin every day, and based on the data that I've seen with the lack of efficacy and the harm, I've even stopped doing my multivitamin. I'm not familiar with Dr. Driscoll's study, but if she's doing it like we did it in a very controlled circumstance with a control arm and under, you know, surveillance, as all clinical trials are done, where the patients are carefully looked at, and we have a safety net of a data safety monitoring board where the board actually gets the data, the investigator doesn't, and the board will call a halt to a trial if there's harm. So I think, you know, I would encourage that we continue to explore micronutrients. The data has been disappointing. Some people think we need to move away from that area of study because it's been so disappointing. So I'll be interested to hear what Dr. Muller has to say.
Mr. Muller, thank you very much. Dr. Runaway, excellent. Thank you.
Yeah, it's an interesting field, the field of micronutrients and alternative or complementary therapies, and that's where you get into fairly unregulated supplements and things that you can purchase on the internet and claim have a lot of claims that they can do a lot of different things. The thing to think about micronutrients, number one, is that there's two fields of study in this. One is for prevention, very, very, very different than taking it during treatment. And a lot of the biologic mechanisms that we know how our drugs work, and now particularly some of our targeted therapies, that intellectually for certain and in some laboratories there's good evidence that introducing micronutrients such as vitamin C or free radical scavengers or a lot of other products can actually negate the actual mechanism of how these drugs work. So until we have really good, well-controlled trials in humans to help us figure out if some of them actually can be helpful in a particular sequence, or are they all going to impact in a negative way, I think we have to be very, very careful of utilizing them, particularly during treatment. Now, in a remissive state, I think that's a different issue.
Thank you very much. That was an excellent question, great answers. Thank you. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from Susan G.
Yes, this has been fascinating. I have a question. I just had a third incident, and the doctor put me on Doxil. I consulted with Maury Markman at MD Anderson because I wanted to take Taxol along with it. I've been through, you know, the IP, and I'm really strong in getting through all these drug treatments. And he said there was no statistical evidence to prove that giving two chemos versus just the one did any better.
Your question?
I hate being part of a statistic rather than just being taken as an individual, except
and your question, please? Your question?
Pardon?
Your question?
Oh, so I just want to know what they feel about Doxil alone or Doxil with Taxol. Is
okay.
One being, you know, is it the same effectiveness, or adding the Taxol might be more effective?
Well, thank you for that excellent question. I'm going to ask our speakers to address your question in a general way, and then we'll, of course, advise you to go back to your treating healthcare team in terms of their tailoring the care to you. Dr. Bonaruth, do you want to start with that one?
Sure. In second-line treatment, after your first therapy is completed and you are diagnosed with a disease recurrence, the data there shows that Taxol in combination with carboplatin, if you've had a significant platinum-free interval, that is your remission is longer than 6 months and ideally longer than 12 months, the patients did better on the combination than in a single agent. That is with both drugs as opposed to just the single drug, carboplatin or Taxol. And there's some data that even if you give it in sequence, it's not as good as when you give it together in the second line. In third line treatment, however, there is no data that combination is better than single agent. So I would accept outside of a clinical trial, and we actually have a clinical trial of Doxil with exabepalone. And exabepalone is a new Taxol derivative that is supposed to be active in Taxol refractory disease. And because of data in the laboratory, we've combined these two drugs, and we're looking first at a phase one, and then we have moved on now to a phase two because we've established the effective dose. So I think outside of a clinical trial, a third-line drug, single agent, is appropriate. Combinations should probably be studied in clinical trials. And I would just caution one caution, and that is once you've had three cycles of therapy, you may be eligible for a clinical trial rather than a drug that's available, what I call street drugs, like Taxol or Carbo or Doxil. These are available to anybody because they've been approved by the FDA. The drugs that are some of the exciting new drugs, like the folate receptor drugs or bevacizumab and others, are only going to be available in a research setting until they're approved by the FDA. And usually those clinical trials will restrict to one or two or maximum three prior therapies. So I would caution everyone on the call that if you are diagnosed with a recurrence, seek out the clinical trials and see, because you may be able to get one of the exciting new drugs, because Doxil will always be there and you can always get it at any point. So I'll turn the mic over to Carolyn, the other
Thank
Carolyn.
You, Dr. Muller, would you like to comment as well?
Yeah, I couldn't have said it any better than that. Right, that's so right on.
Okay. All right. Well, then I hope that helps you, and you'll, of course, go back to your treating healthcare team, but we hope this has been helpful to you and many other participants on the call as well. Our next question, please.
Our next question is from Cheryl J. Cheryl J., your line is open. Please check your mute button.
Okay, hello.
Hi, Cheryl. Your question?
Yes. I'm an oncology social worker, and I think all of these cancer calls and all of the work you do is absolutely fantastic, and I applaud all of you 100%. But especially with ovarian cancer, and I've listened to a lot of these, and I think all the work that's being done is wonderful in the clinical trials, but I would love to hear what more is going on with earlier detection, opposed to waiting till it gets to stage 3 or stage 4, that a woman can't do anything when it's at the earlier stages. Is there anything being done on the preventative end?
Okay, well, thank you for that excellent question. I know it's a question that's on many people's minds. I'm going to ask Dr. Bonaruth and Dr. Muller to address this question. Dr. Muller, do you want to take this one first? And then...
I'm going to leave the ASCO report to Dr. Runowitz because I unfortunately didn't make the meeting, but I think she can talk a little bit more about that screening study that used the combination of CA125 and ultrasound. This is still a very, very active level of research, and I think Dr. Runowitz made a very important statement earlier on, is that we're still not 100% clear what the disease comes from and how it originates. So it makes it a little bit difficult until we understand that to be able to effectively figure out preventative strategies. With that said, we certainly know that in well-selected patients that risk reduction surgery will be helpful, but again, that's a small percentage of patients. There's still a lot of work being done looking for a marker panel that will be more predictive of more predictive for early detection. You know, we've seen over the years the rise and fall of certain technologies such as proteomics, but what I will tell you from a research perspective is that there are incredibly powerful teams now of basic scientists, people that are skilled in technology, and the clinicians that are coming together to really try to push the field forward in being creative at finding new ways to detect either higher risk or detect early cancers.
Excellent. Dr. Ronowitz?
Yeah, I can't add a lot more. There have been some studies that have looked at different agents like retinoids. In Europe, these are used like we used to use tamoxifen in the adjuvant setting for breast cancer. And in one of the Italian studies, they noted that women on retinoids, which is a derivative of the beta carotene, and it's a drug as opposed to, say, the micronutrient, and they found that the women that were on the retinoids had zero incidence of ovarian cancer as compared to the arm that had the sugar pill. So there may be ways of preventing. We know that the birth control pill has an effect on the prevention of ovarian cancer, and we think that that's the progesterone. So there, as Carolyn said, there are labs looking at the mechanisms to understand why retinoids would prevent ovarian cancer or why progesterones would prevent ovarian cancer. And I'm optimistic that with new technologies, with new mathematical models, understanding how these agents work at a cellular pathway, we'll be able to come up with either ways to prevent the disease or a vaccine to prevent the disease. I'm not optimistic about the screening strategies as we know them today. And I think I went over the screening studies from this year. I think the jury's out.
Okay. Thank you very much. All right. Our next question, please.
Our next question comes from LaDonna C.
Hi. I don't know much about symptoms of these diseases, but I heard you saying chemo brain, and could you tell me what the symptoms may be and how that's controlled?
Dr. Muller, could you address that?
Sure, and I suspect there are several hundred women on the call that can probably tell you better than I. But chemo brain is a very interesting term that's used by a lot of our patients because during treatment, it is a little bit harder to for women to focus. Their short-term memory becomes compromised. I feel like I need to give everybody a little post-it notes to sometimes help them get through the day. And it's truly reproducible, and it happens not only in women with ovarian cancer, but in patients who get chemotherapy across all cancers. The cause of the cognitive function issues is not known, and there's some neurosciences that are really beginning to start looking at some of the brain issues on chemotherapy, whether it's cell effects or whether it's because of byproducts of tumor kill. I mean, nobody understands it at all. But there is a very interesting clinical trial that's opened by the GOG, which prospectively is trying to measure the degree and type of cognitive dysfunction in women who start therapy primarily at the time of diagnosis of ovarian cancer. And so I think we will – this is work that was done by Lisa Hess, who's a PhD formerly in Arizona, but now is in Indiana. And I think within some amount of time, we will get a much better handle over what causes that particular problem and how we might be able to, you know, help either prevent it or help women through it.
And I just want to encourage anyone who is feeling that they're having some difficulty with their memory or finding a word or just word processing or even doing the multitasking during treatment, that those are things that people can often help you with. There's a lot of, I know we have a lot of materials on that subject, and we have also done some teleconferences on that subject as well. So I would encourage you to go ahead and call our staff here at Cancer Care for your individual help needs around that, as well as talk directly with, of course, your treating healthcare team, who also may have members of the team who could kind of help you. There are some often very helpful tips that can be given to people, cognitive tips, which we draw from rehabilitation medicine, that actually can often help with dealing with some of those things that really can be disruptive on for your quality of life on a day-to-day basis, so as many of you know. So do feel free to reach out and ask for help, and there is help available. And I think, as Dr. Muller has said, there's a great deal of work being done in this area as well. Well, I want to thank our speakers. They've just been extraordinary. I want to thank both of them. Just an amazing call. Just really exceptional. I want to thank all of you who have asked such really great questions. You know, your questions really help to enhance the call. It gives our speakers an opportunity to speak further about some issues that are of concern to each of you. And, of course, all of you who have been listening. Now, I want to remind you that this is a one-hour program. However, in planning a program like this, we do recognize that you have many needs that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. And so with that in mind, I want to remind all of you that although the program will end shortly, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those are endless, and those continue. They're free services, and those are there for you, you know, beyond the scope of this program. And those services are that we have 60 NASA's level trained oncology social workers who are here to really help you and talk with you about some of your concerns. We provide practical and financial assistance, so that's an important piece. We also offer a variety of opportunities to talk with professional staff, counseling services, one-on-one. We also offer telephone support groups, and some of you like online support groups as well. And we provide services to both women living with ovarian cancer, their caregivers, loved ones, people who are living with cancer. Our services are really for everyone. So that's there. We also have a program that helps children in families to understand cancer in the family, and also to help adults and women and family members talk to children about cancer in the family and ovarian cancer in the family. So we have lots of different services that you can access. We also, of course, have these Connect workshops, these educational workshops, and lots of materials as well. So in conclusion, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with ovarian cancer and coping with cancer. I want you to now feel that you're part of a community of support, and we are truly here to help you. And we are simply a phone call away, and I hope you'll take advantage of these free services. And I want to wish you all a very fine day, and I want to thank you all for participating.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.